Well, I wonder whether you thought the coronation was a worthy act to honour the king or a massive waste of money. A friend of mine works sort of near Westminster Abbey, and he said on the lead up, the roads around there were shut, not just because of security, because they were relaying the roads to make sure everything was just right. The golden carriage. Do you remember the golden carriage the king travelled in? Apparently, if you took the gold off that and melted it down, it'd be worth £28 million. Just imagine what that carriage, that ornate carriage, is worth. To put on the coronation, they estimate it cost something in the region of £100 million. Now, do you think that is a worthy act, or do you think it's a massive waste of money? And were you one of those people who found yourselves asking this question, going, well, what about the poor? What about the poor? Well, wherever you fall on the debate, those are the questions that are swirling around as we look at John chapter 12 this morning, as we see a number of people responding to Jesus. And there is one dramatic big act. And the question really we're asking is Jesus worth it? Is he worth it? Someone loves him. Others are using him. Some hate him. Is Jesus worth it, and why does it matter? Now, before we jump into this passage and have a look to see what's going on, I'm just going to take a little sidebar, okay? So we can do a little aside. Hang in with me for 5 minutes or so, because this is one of those passages that people sometimes will point to and say, do you know, the Bible contradicts itself. You can't really believe it's God's word, because this passage contradicts some other passages. And what we have in this incident, as Jesus is anointed in this way, is it is in Matthew and Mark. And although lots of the big picture detail is the same, there are some small things that on first reading appear to contradict each other. Now, if you are new to this church, just so you know, we really do believe this is God's living and active word. And we believe that not just about what it tells us about theology and about the doctrine of God and the gospel, we also believe that about what it tells us about the details of history. And I think what you can find, it's just a Bible reading tool, is that when you carefully read the text and think about it a little, often you can work out some potential answers to clear up the difficulty. Just, you know, a few weeks ago, we had a team of Americans over to our house, and my wife and I might tell different stories about this evening. If you were going to ask me about that evening, I think I would tell you that I played Viking chess with 8 Americans. And for those of you who don't, it's a game called Cub, Viking chess. You end up throwing bits of wood at other bits of wood. It's a lot of fun. I played Viking chess with 8 Americans that evening and smashed them, and it was fantastic. Okay, that's what I would tell you about that evening. Whereas Grace would tell you, I fed 13 Americans. We had a fantastic barbecue. We sat around, we ate, we chatted. It was a really good evening. Now, you look at those two tellings of the evening, and you could say, that's a bit contradictory. Andy, you said there were 8, and Grace, you said there were 13. Andy, you said you played Cub, and Grace said you fed them. And obviously, you know, it doesn't take a genius to go, well, actually, that all happened on the same night. And not every American played Cub. And you can kind of synthesize the details, because myself and Grace are telling you about the same event, but we're telling you different details because we want to emphasize something different. Grace's culinary excellence, my absolute competence at Cub. And I will play you someday. Maybe I will take it. There's my wife. I'm just talking about you, love. Okay. So maybe I'll bring it to the picnic and I'll take you on at Cub and you can try and have a go. Two people seeing the same events, and actually the details are just complementary. Well, Matthew, Mark would have been getting stuff from Peter. John would have been there. they are dealing with eyewitness testimony, and they are eyewitnesses themselves. And so as they talk about these events, sometimes they tell different moments because they are emphasizing something important because they're trying to teach us. And they're not necessarily contradictory. So let me just say that the three things, okay, hang on with me. There's only another 2 minutes of this and we'll get back to the text, right? But there's three things that people pick out in this passage. Firstly, the location. So in Matthew and Mark, we're told that this happens in Bethany. It is in Bethany. And we're told that it's in Simon the leper's house. But when we read this account in John, it's really clear that Mary and Martha are serving Jesus. The meal is kind of, they are serving Jesus. Now, how could you put those details together? Well, it could be that Mary and Martha are renting Simon the leper's house. It could be that Simon the leper is their dad and owns this house. It could be that this was such a big event, they said, hey, Simon the leper, can we come and have it at your house? And they've cooked at his place. Could be a whole host of reasons. So they're not necessarily contradictory. Or how about the anointing? You see, Matthew and Mark say that Jesus was anointed on the head. And John says Jesus was anointed on the feet. Now, how could you put that together? Well, we're going to find out. There's a lot of nard. There's a lot of expensive perfume here. And so there would have been quite easily enough for it to go on his head and his feet. And it may be that they're emphasizing those different details because they're trying to teach a different point. Matthew and Mark may be emphasizing more about Jesus being the king, and it's like an anointing of the king. Whereas actually in John's gospel, what do you have in chapter 13? You have the washing of the feet. Now, you don't get that in the other gospels. And so it may be that John's got another point to make as she goes and washes his feet with this something about humility and service. And there's a third thing, there's timing. Timing thing. So Matthew and Mark clearly said this event happened 2 days before, whereas John says it happened 6 days before. Now again, it could be two different events, but I really don't think it is. I think it's one event. And one of the things you've got to understand, as the gospel writers are writing, they're not necessarily putting everything in absolutely chronological order. So Matthew and Mark are probably less chronological than John. And it's probably a bit like experiencing a Christopher Nolan film. If anyone has seen a Christopher Nolan film, Dunkirk, Oppenheimer recently out, he always tells his stories on a number of different time levels because he's putting them together, running different time levels at the same time, telling you the story because he's trying to make bigger points. And that's kind of what you get in Matthew and Mark. So there are potentially some ways you can synthesize the details, and maybe you've got some better explanations than that. But I guess I'm saying that just to say, don't be thrown if people say to you, oh, the Bible always contradicts itself, and you look at this and you go, well, actually, you can work that out. This is a trustworthy word. You really can stand on it. So there you go. That is the sidebar. Have you fallen asleep? You can come back in the room, right? Let's have a look what happens. That was a bigger side. Here is the question. Is Jesus worth it? And let's start by looking at this extravagant act of love. And you've got to understand, as we enter into verses 1 and 2, you are entering into an absolutely electric dinner party. Right? You would have wanted to listen to this. Verse 1. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. That's in chapter 11. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with them. Okay, so here is a meal, and sat near Jesus is Lazarus, who was literally dead for 4 days in a tomb. And his sisters have put on this dinner party to celebrate what Jesus has done. And Jesus is there, and Lazarus is there. And boy, that's going to be a party, isn't it? You know, a friend of mine, he's in the army, and he often goes away on tours, away for 3 months, 6 months. And his wife was saying, when he comes back, that first meal, when he is sat at the table, and the family's there, she said, it is just joy. Now, this is not someone who's been away for 6 months. They were dead. and the atmosphere, it would be crackling. There's Jesus, there's Lazarus, there's this food. I mean, you're going to put on a pretty good spread, don't you think? But then what happens next? Mary takes the event to the next level. Have a look at verse 3. Then Mary took about half a liter of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet, wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of this perfume. Now, apparently this pure nard, you'd only be able to get it from India. This is really precious. It's the amount of basically like a shampoo bottle. And there's a shampoo bottle full of this really niche perfume. And she just all over Jesus, on his feet. Why is it such a big deal? You saw it in verse 5. It's worth a year's wages. And if you just think about modern day salary, you're talking about 28, 30K. Okay, that's about a modern day average salary in the UK. And what does she do with it? Now just imagine, okay, just imagine for a moment. You had 30K left, just knocking about. What would you do with 30K? Seriously, you knew someone who had 30K. What would you do? I'll tell you what. The bathroom needs redoing. You get a little extension on that. Oh, you could get a car. You would say, use the money on something that's going to last a little bit. You know, you want to invest the money in something that's going to be, you know, substantial. And she gets it and all gone. All gone on Jesus. You know, that year of grafting, working extra hours, and it disappears in a moment. And as you see that and you hear that, don't you think a little bit, what a waste? What a waste. You know, look at Judas's point, verse 5. Why wasn't that perfume sold and the money given to the poor? And there's a sense in which, don't you think he has a point? You know, just think what 30K could do for some of these charities around here who try and help the homeless or help people who are really struggling. 30K, that is a lot of good could be done with that money. You know, don't you think Jesus should have said, as she started pouring on, whoa, Mary, just stick it back in. I appreciate the thought, but surely, like, let's use that money and put it to good use. Let's go and help some people. And yet, what does Jesus do? He doesn't stop her. He doesn't say it's too much. I don't know if you remember, there was an advert. And again, it was big in the 90s and the noughties. So some of you wouldn't have been born. Maybe they still use it. But I think it was an advert for slightly posh shampoo that wasn't that cheap. Was it L'Oreal Paris? And they had people like Jennifer Aniston and this was the tagline, because you're worth it. Do you remember that? They wash their hair in the shampoo and they look at the camera and they go, because you're worth it. Jesus is drenched in a year's salary. And he looks and says, it's fine because I'm worth it. I'm literally worth it. In fact, what does he say? Verse 7, leave her alone. Leave her alone. She was doing what was right. I'm worth this. Now, what do you think? Why wasn't this a waste? Why wasn't this a waste? Let's have a think about this for a moment. Why wasn't this a waste? Why do you think she is anointing Jesus? Why do you think she's just pouring £30,000 on him? Well, just think. When you initially think about it, it's kind of obvious, isn't it? Who is at this meal? Verse 1. Lazarus, whom Jesus raised from the dead. What is this dinner? This dinner is in Jesus' honor. They're literally sat there with Mary's brother Lazarus, who earlier this week was dead, and Jesus brought back from the dead. And how do you think you could repay that? You know, if you knew someone who had literally rescued a close member of your family from death, what could you repay a person like that? You know, they've given you something that no one else can give you. And so look at what Jesus says. Verse 7, "Leave her alone," Jesus replied. "She's giving thanks because I'm here eating some falafel with Lazarus, and it's all because of me." Jesus doesn't say that, does he? Look what he says. "It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial." See, what is she doing? She is doing this not just because of the resurrection of Lazarus, and whether she realizes it or not, this is talking about the resurrection to life of all who trust in Jesus. Because Jesus says, "This is about my death." It's not just about elevating Lazarus from the dead for a few years, but about Jesus defeating death fully and finally for all eternity. Now, look, if you've been around City Gates for the past year or so, we've been dipping in and out of John's Gospel. And John's Gospel verses chapters 1 to 10, they track the first 3 years of Jesus' ministry. And we're in chapters 11 through to 21, and they track the last week. And all the way, the first half of the gospel, 1 to 10, Jesus repeatedly says, "It's not time yet. It's not time yet." But in chapters 11 to 21, he says, "No, it is time. The time has come." And what has the time come for? Just have a look at chapter 12, verse 24. And this is a verse that shapes a lot of what we're going to be thinking about over the next few weeks in John's Gospel. Chapter 12, verse 24. Look at what Jesus says. In fact, verse 23, have a look at that. "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." And what is he talking about the Son of Man being glorified? Verse 24. "Very truly I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it will produce many seeds." See, Jesus is absolutely clear, as this 30,000 pounds of gorgeous smell is poured on his feet, is poured on his head. It is absolutely appropriate because he is being prepared for his death. You see, his death on the cross, the glorious purpose of that is to bring life to all who trust in him as he satisfies the justice of God. As he steps in and takes the bullet for his people, the bullet we all deserve. And so Jesus can say, look, at this moment, you'll always have the poor with you. It's not about the poor, but Jesus is saying, as I pour out my life in death, my death and resurrection is the only way to solve the issue of poverty for all eternity. See, Jesus here is saying this is absolutely appropriate. This is outrageous devotion if you understand what I'm about to do to save you. This is worship because he's worth it. Now look, I'm aware here there'll be people here who've been Christians for years and years and years. There'll be some people here who maybe you're looking into the Christian faith, or you're not sure where you are. And what we've got to understand, Jesus is holding up this as a right and logical response to who he is. And maybe you're not a Christian here. And I want to say to you, if you haven't come to understand this point, that Jesus is worth everything, not just 30,000 pounds, but actually he's worth my life. He's worth devoting my whole life to. My car, my house, my family, my career. He is the one who deserves it all. If you haven't come to understand that yet, then I probably want to say you haven't understood Christianity yet. I want to say, keep coming. Keep coming. Keep asking Jesus, help me to understand why Mary treats you in this way, because I still don't get it. But I guess there'll be others of us here who've been Christians for years and years, and it may have been a moment in time where we just heard, Jesus died for my sins, and I'm a sinner, and he's forgiven me, and you put your trust in him, and it felt like nothing else mattered. But then the years go on, and the bills come, and there's decisions, and life is hard, and things don't quite go as you expect, and that love for Christ diminishes and gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and you look at this, and you think, 30K, what could I do with 30K? And if that is you, if that is your heart, you know, maybe you just need to say, Jesus, I want to be a bit like Mary. Remind me. Help me to grasp the depth and the magnitude of the cross. Well, there's love. Okay, love is a response. But there's two other responses. I don't know whether you noticed them. The other one is Jesus being used. And that is Judas. Just have a look at verse 4. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected, why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used it to help himself to what was put into it. And so here you have Judas. And just think, who is Judas? He'd been one of the 12. He'd been out preaching with Jesus. He'd literally seen firsthand. That guy was blind and now he can see. You know, he would have feasted on bread as he saw Jesus give thanks and turn 2 loaves and 5 fishes into a feast for 5,000. And he experienced that. He repeatedly experienced the kindness and grace at the hand of Christ. And yet the rottenness of his heart goes so deep that as he sees Jesus, all he can see is money for his own pocket. It's just rank hypocrisy, isn't it? It's just so, so ugly. Judas is saying one thing with his words. It's about the poor, but his heart was, his actions were betraying the reality of his heart. See, treasure for him in this world was worth more to him than Jesus and eternity. And so he looks at Jesus and thinks he's only worth being used. Just to say, look, if your desire is to use God to get rich, if I come to God who will make me financially rich, then you do need to understand that actually God is not the one you're worshipping, money is. And that leaves you in a really bad place. Always beware the ministry where there's real hypocrisy with regards to money. So there they are. There's someone who's using Jesus, but the final thing, there's people who hate him. Just have a look at 9 to 11. This is quite remarkable, okay? Read this. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he'd raised from the dead. And let's face it, who can blame them? If you'd been to a funeral, and then a few days later, he said, no, he's alive, you'd want to go and see him. Or even if you didn't know the guy. Word would have spread. They're all desperate to go and try and get a view of Lazarus and Jesus who did it. Loads of them. But look what happens next. Verse 20. The chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. And I just want to say, look how wicked the human heart can be. Okay, here are the chief priests, and they're the ones who are meant, as Jesus came, and he's clearly the king, and he's clearly the Messiah, they're meant to say, it's him. He's the one who it's all about. It's so plain he's God's Messiah. And it's interesting, isn't it? They're not denying that Lazarus was raised from the dead. They're not trying to produce evidence saying, no, this didn't really happen. No, look, rather than acknowledging that Jesus is the Messiah, he is the King, and he is the one we should devote our lives to, rather than dealing with the evidence and repenting and responding, they would rather murder the evidence. Now just imagine Lazarus, what a week he's had. He was in the grave, now he's alive, now there's other people who want to kill him. Poor chap. But it just shows the depth of the hate. I don't want Jesus telling me what to do. I don't want to hand over the ownership of my life to him. And so rather than responding rightly, they go, we're just going to crush the evidence. See, what do you gain if you gain the whole world and lose your soul? What can you do in exchange for your soul? So I guess the question we're left with is he worth it? You know, is he worth it? How are you responding? Not how have you responded, but how are you responding today? How are you responding right now? And maybe our hearts have been exposed a bit by Mary and we think, wow, I really do need to pray for the Lord to help remind me of how glorious he is. Now, love is shown in this passage in a number of ways. Lazarus loves hanging out with Jesus. Martha's really keen to serve Jesus. Mary is always at Jesus' feet, learning, grieving, and weeping. But they all love him. And that's a life well lived. I remember being, there was a time when I was sort of trying to work out what I wanted to do with my life. And I went to visit a dentist. The dentist was in my church. I was doing work experience. And I remember having a chat with one of the people who were about to get into the chair there. And I was explaining, my brother, my eldest brother, he's got fantastic teeth. He trained as a dentist. He was a good dentist. But he gave it up to study theology and become a pastor, to become a preacher. And this lady, I'll never forget the words as they came out of her lips. She said, what a waste. I think Grace and I have been spending some time with a really good friend over these past few days. She's someone who became a Christian from a Sikh background. And one of the things that she felt like it meant for her, to honor her parents, she wouldn't marry another Sikh man who they wanted her to honor. But to honor her parents, she just said, oh, I won't marry anyone at all. What a waste. Think some missionary friends who are about to come back from the mission field, and they said, when we first took our kids away, it was fine, but every time we visited back, we just saw friends, and they were doing better and better in their jobs, and their houses were getting bigger and bigger, and we were just sort of in the same place, and at times that was really painful, and you could look on and think, what a waste. Now those are big, dramatic, extravagant moments of sacrifice. And we've got to know that actually Jesus knows it all. J.C. Ryle, he put it like this. He was a bishop from a few hundred years ago. He said this: a day is coming when the wandering world will see every cup of cold water given for Christ's sake, as well as every box of precious ointment was recorded in heaven and has its reward. You have to understand that as sacrifices are made for Christ, he smells it, and it smells glorious. Is it a waste? It's only a waste if you're serving someone like King Charles. Let me put this in context. One of the things I did enjoy about the coronation was some of the promises that were made. As King Charles was given a sword and this orb, I don't know how many of you saw it. You'll have seen some of the photos. And in essence, some of the liturgy was, you have authority to execute justice. It was all so grand and powerful. And the reality is, King Charles has the power to open a lot of leisure centres and new community hubs, doesn't he? That's basically what he does. Bless him. And they do a great job. And we're, you know, figurehead. And anyway, let's not get into that. But Jesus is the one who will raise us from the dead. He's the one who's given his life for us and has all authority, and anything, any life given to him, it's not a waste. It's right. Let's bow our heads. Let's bow our heads. I'll just give you a few moments just to think and maybe respond in your heart That's what the Lord might be saying to you.